Welcome back to the Jewish Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Moses Lappin, and today I'm joined by Professor Daniel Schwartz to discuss his book, The First Modern Jew, Spinoza and the History of an Image, published in 2012 by Princeton University Press. Professor Schwartz is an associate professor of history and the director of the Judaic Studies program at George Washington University. Our topic of conversation today, The First Modern Jew, Spinoza and the History of an Image, is a history of the reception of Spinoza that spans the 17th to 21st centuries in Western and Eastern Europe, as well as in America and Israel. It's a work that uncovers the malleable nature of Spinoza as a symbol in many different contexts. Research over the last several decades has placed Spinoza at the center of many different intellectual and cultural currents, marking him, perhaps, as the intellectual hero of the early modern period. Rather than focus on his philosophy and intellectual influence, in his book, Professor Schwartz seeks to understand Spinoza as a cultural figure to Jews, an image that turns up in many crucial junctures in modern Jewish history, at times in conflict with one another. In our conversation today, we will explore the uses of this image to better understand modernity in a larger sense and the question of identity. What does it mean to be a Jew? Although the book is not new, I chose to have Professor Schwartz on the podcast today to spotlight one of the most innovative books in Jewish studies, a book that I believe demands a wider audience. Not only is it a unique contribution to the crowded discourse on Spinoza and provides a new avenue to understand the course of modern Jewish history, its scope and depth and breadth and methodological sophistication allows it to be read fruitfully from many different angles. Welcome, Professor Schwartz, to the New Books Network. I'm delighted to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we begin in earnest, let's talk a little bit about reception history. What does that mean, and how is it different from other historiographical methods?
Sure. Reception history is basically the attempt to kind of trace how anything from a particular biographical figure to a specific work to a particular idea or a body of ideas. The aim is to understand how any of the above that I mentioned were kind of subsequently interpreted, often kind of reworked, repackaged, all in light of, kind of changes in the times. And so it's a way of trying to understand not just simply the figure or the ideas in their original historical context, but actually to get a better gauge on how they were understood and how they were effective. And so I think it's, it's a crucial branch of both intellectual and cultural history.
The title of your book is The First Modern Jew. And yet you write in the introduction that you don't argue that Spinoza was the quote-unquote first modern Jew or the beginning of modern Jewish history. Can you give us a sense of the type of questions the book does seek to understand and the role of the image of Spinoza in doing this?
I kind of was mainly interested in understanding kind of the genesis of this particular, not just image of Spinoza, but this idea about where kind of Jewish modernity begins. And obviously there's been, a whole literature debating the origins of modern Jewish history, the modern period of Jewish history. There are only so many people who have actually argued that we should begin in 17th century Amsterdam with Spinoza specifically. And yet this is a kind of a recurring motif or trope, this idea of Spinoza as, the first modern, sometimes, the first secular Jew, although I would argue that those are not, synonymous. But basically what I was interested in understanding is, how did Spinoza come to be seen in this way? Because obviously as a kind of description of Spinoza's own biography, right, that is a label that really has no meaning, which isn't to say that it, can't be applied. I mean, often historians, we use concepts that were unknown to the figures themselves. But nevertheless, you know, Spinoza did not kind of justify his departures from Jewish law, from traditional Jewish beliefs, on the basis of this idea that I'm a new type of Jew, I'm a modern Jew, I'm a secular Jew. And so I was interested in understanding both the kind of origins of this idea and then its subsequent history. And what was interesting to me was to see just how many different iterations of the idea that there were. So it's almost a kind of genealogy of a particular idea about Spinoza and its effects.
Your book is, in a sense, a chronological narrative of modern Jewish history. It begins in 17th century Amsterdam, before moving to 18th century Berlin and 19th century Eastern Europe, and then on to Israel and America in the 20th century. What led you to work on the project? And could you tell us a little bit about the genesis and the way in which the project unfolded?
When I was studying in graduate school at Columbia, that was where I did my PhD in Jewish history. My mentor was the late Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, and I had taken a number of courses with him that related to issues of historical texts or history and memory. During some of our conversations, when we would talk about possible dissertation topics, you know, I would mention that kind of broadly speaking, I was also interested in exploring the kind of nexus of historical conscious understood, historical consciousness understood in a kind of broad manner, that it would, you know, encompass both kind of historiography, but also collective memory. The nexus between that and constructions of modern Jewish identity. And he was actually the one who, you know, planted the idea in my head of exploring kind of Spinoza's reception. He actually had a copy of a important bibliography of works related to Spinoza, sometimes called Spinozana, that was compiled by a librarian at the Hebrew Union College in the early 20th century, whose name was Adolf Akko, who was an avid Spinozist. And he had compiled all sorts of index cards, mimeographed them that related to Spinoza in some fashion, and they were, you know, categorized by period, subject. And so this gave me a real kind of source to begin with. But I really, I didn't know entirely what the scope of it would be. And, you know, that evolved over time. And, you know, as I kind of moved farther into it, I thought, you know, this really is something that I would like to try to take up until the present. You know, what I tend to do is often kind of like parachute into key moments, as you said at the beginning, like kind of key junctures in the development of modern Jewish history, or the kind of emergence of new Jewish ideologies, and to look at kind of at those moments, you know, try to kind of get a better sense of Spinoza's reception.
Spinoza is famous for being excommunicated, a concept that to someone in 2018 may seem a bit strange. What does it mean that he was a heretic? And can you begin to tell us a little bit of his reception in 17th century Amsterdam by Jews and non-Jews, both during his life and after he passed?
I mean, I think, you know, the definition of a heretic, there are various kind of, you know, sayings in the Talmud, you know, or in, you know, rabbinic literature about certain beliefs that if one rejects, you know, one doesn't have a place in the world to come. But you don't have the same type of kind of, you know, clearly worked out doctrinal ideas of what constitutes heresy in Judaism that you would, let's say, in Catholicism. But nevertheless, let's put it this way. If Spinoza were disseminating the kind of ideas that he would later publish in the theological political treatise, questioning the divine origin of scripture, questioning the supernatural nature of God or biblical miracles, questioning the validity of Jewish law, all of these ideas would certainly be enough to kind of remove one self from the fold. That said, you know, this was a very interesting community, this Amsterdam community, in that it was comprised, at least initially, the Sephardic community was comprised of former conversos, people who had lived as new Christians in Spain or Portugal and had escaped to Amsterdam, where they were able to kind of return, so to speak, even though often they had been generations removed from kind of open Judaism, but they were able to kind of return to kind of rabbinic Judaism. But it was a community that was somewhat insecure as a result. And so they would often use excommunication to punish a whole range of behaviors, including conduct that was far less grave than that of Spinoza. So it wasn't necessarily so unusual that the community would resort to excommunication of some sort. What was striking was the extent of it, the sweep of it, that this wasn't just a case of excommunicating Spinoza for a week or so, or saying, you know, that for such and such a time you can't be called to the Torah. This was basically a total anathema. And, you know, really, you know, a kind of just total expulsion of Spinoza from the community. You know, although there are many who think that kind of Spinoza, you know, there was a 20th century biographer of Spinoza named Louis Foyer who said that Spinoza had essentially decommunicated himself before he was excommunicated. But in terms of his early reception, you know, a lot of it kind of really began in earnest in the 1670s. So Spinoza is excommunicated in 1656, publishes a work, the only work really published under his own name, in 1663, which is basically a kind of reinterpretation of certain Cartesian principles. But the first kind of scandalous work that he publishes is the Theological Political Treatise, which I mentioned before, in 1670. And he publishes it anonymously, but it doesn't seem like anybody was really fooled. And this is when Spinoza really becomes this kind of, you know, bête noire of the, you know, kind of theological establishment throughout Europe, and not just theologians. You know, ordinary individuals were troubled by what Spinoza was saying as well. And so you have the beginning of a torrent of anti-Spinozist literature, which only kind of gains in intensity after Spinoza dies in 1677, and his posthumous works are published, which include his magnum opus, The Ethics. This is where he essentially argues that there is only one substance, which we can call either God or nature. And both books are placed on the Inquisition's list of forbidden books. They're banned throughout Europe. Again, you have this flood of anti-Spinozist literature. What's striking to me is that at least in the early phases, you know, the first 100 years or so after Spinoza's excommunication from Sephardic Amsterdam, the number of actually Jewish responses to his thought is surprisingly small. And perhaps, you know, maybe we might then say not surprisingly, given that part of the excommunication or the writ of excommunication actually forbid reading anything that was written by him, so that anybody who was going to write a formal response, you know, could be, you know, held responsible for actually reading his stuff. But, you know, we don't necessarily know how effective that taboo was in actually, you know, preventing Jews from reading Spinoza. But there is really a paucity of Jewish responses. There are a few incidents that appear to involve Spinoza's philosophy, including a controversy that happens in the early 18th century in England, involving a rabbi named David, or David Nieto, who was the rabbi of the Sephardic synagogue in London, who gave a sermon where he basically identified God with nature. What he meant by it was something very different from what Spinoza intended, but nevertheless, there was an accusation, at least, that he was disseminating pantheism. He was ultimately kind of exculpated of this in a rabbinic opinion by a German rabbi, Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi, the father of Jacob Emden, a very important 18th century rabbi. But for the most part, there really isn't much in terms of a Jewish response to Spinoza. Most of the responses to Spinoza, whether positive or more frequently negative, were from Christians.
The first setting outside of Amsterdam you explore in the book is Moses Mendelssohn's Berlin. And you cover two central topics there. The first is the question of the relationship between religion and state, or creed and law, particularly as it pertains to Jews. What role did Spinoza's image play here? And the second thing you cover in this chapter is the quote-unquote Spinoza controversy. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about Spinozism and why it was such a lightning rod for controversy.
In terms of your first question, I mean, the kind of relationship between kind of religion and state, this became, a crucial issue among kind of Enlightenment thinkers, including Mendelssohn. And Moses Mendelssohn, this, kind of great 18th century German philosopher, a stalwart of the kind of German Enlightenment, but also a crucial figure in the kind of genealogy of the Jewish Enlightenment. Late in his life, wrote a work entitled Jerusalem that was really written in order to kind of defend the idea that Judaism was not a kind of theocratic religion, so that one could kind of embrace fundamentally liberal principles while remaining a loyal Jew. And what's interesting is that even though Spinoza really isn't kind of directly referenced in the book, but you can see Mendelssohn kind of almost appropriating certain Spinozist ideas. So, for example, the idea that the Torah, or the Mosaic law, that it was kind of fundamentally legislative, that there was kind of initially a kind of theocratic element to it, but the idea was that it was supposed to be a legal system, not, like kind of Christianity, a body of, mysteries or dogmas, but it was supposed to relate to actions in particular. Whereas kind of Spinoza had used this to argue that once the ancient kind of Hebrew commonwealth, once it was destroyed, the Mosaic law lost its validity. Mendelssohn argues, no, it didn't lose its validity. It simply became a voluntary law. But because of its voluntarism, it kind of posed no threat to, kind of full kind of membership in, the modern state. In other words, it wasn't, a kind of a separate legal system that, conflicted with state law. So you can see kind of Mendelssohn kind of almost like working with Spinoza, kind of taking, certain elements of Spinoza's thought that he thinks can be kind of worked in a certain direction, and then taking them in a direction that he thinks is both, kind of compatible with, the idea of kind of inclusion of Jews in the state, but also with, the continued validity and authority, even if only in a voluntary sense, of Jewish law. That you can see how kind of Spinoza has become relevant there to issues of, religion and state. In terms of the second question, this Spinoza controversy, of the 1780s. I mean, it's a complicated subject in that it involved, you know, a whole host of German philosophers at the time. But the two who were really at the center, in addition to Mendelssohn, was Mendelssohn's, friend, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, the great, you know, kind of 18th century German philosopher, classicist, playwright. And according to this other philosopher, whose name was Friedrich Jacobi, who was different from both Lessing and Mendelssohn in that he really wasn't a rationalist. He was a kind of anti-rationalist philosopher who believed that philosophy, rationalist philosophy, if kind of taken to its extreme, kind of naturally culminated in Spinozism, in this kind of elimination of free will, in this kind of total determinism. And he claimed, Jacobi, he had had these conversations with Lessing toward the end of Lessing's life. Lessing died in 1781. He claimed that Lessing had essentially admitted to him that he was a Spinozist. And so this became this whole kind of back and forth, this kind of private correspondence between Jacobi and Mendelssohn, where Jacobi is reporting this to Mendelssohn, and Mendelssohn is trying to kind of either deny it or preempt it or to try to spin it in a way that would be kind of least damaging to Lessing's reputation. But eventually this whole debate went public. Mendelssohn actually published a work where he essentially tried to kind of preempt this whole critique of Lessing and really of Enlightenment philosophy by arguing that Lessing, if he had embraced Spinoza or Spinozism, that it was what Mendelssohn called a kind of refined Spinozism or a refined pantheism, which would be closer to what kind of scholars of religion would call panentheism, which is a term kind of that distinguishes pantheism, which would kind of conflate God and the universe. Panentheism would argue with essentially that the universe is kind of almost like fully permeated by God, but that God still somehow exceeds the universe. And there were other, there were other ways in which, he tried to kind of save Lessing's reputation as well. The fact that Mendelssohn had gone public with this then led Jacobi to publish this whole correspondence that he had had with Mendelssohn, all these reports of his conversations with Lessing, and it became something of a kind of ugly feud that kind of then brought in other philosophers of the day, from Kant to Herder, all kind of weighing in on this issue, really not even so much of whether Lessing himself was a Spinozist, but whether Enlightenment philosophy kind of naturally culminated in Spinozism.
The book then continues in discussing the little remembered figure of Berthold Auerbach, who translated Spinoza's work to German and wrote an introductory biography as well as a historical novel. Who was Auerbach, and what was his effort to convert Spinoza? And how does this relate to his context, one of Jewish emancipation?
So Auerbach is somebody who's not very, an author, certainly not a household name today. But he was a very well-known German author in the 19th century, whose work was published into a whole host of languages. He was kind of particularly renowned for these so-called Dorfgeschichten, or kind of village stories that kind of attempted to depict this kind of peasant culture in the Swabian region that Auerbach was from, during this period of modernization. So, as this way of life is kind of vanishing, it's an attempt to kind of preserve it. But Auerbach kind of began his career before he kind of got around to writing these Dorfgeschichten and became more of simply a German author in the 1840s. He began his writing career with this whole ambition of writing a series of Jewish works that would basically almost do the same thing for Jewish life, that would present kind of traditional Jewish life in the midst of disappearing, under the pressures of modernization. And before he even got around to doing that, Auerbach had initially planned to become a rabbi in the mold of one of his friends and really mentors, Abraham Geiger. So this kind of leading figure, in the kind of reform movement that's beginning to crystallize, in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. Auerbach had initially wanted to pursue that path for various reasons. He was unable to, but he was certainly influenced by this kind of reformist idea of Judaism, with its idea, of a Judaism undergoing, continual kind of evolution through time, the halakha or Jewish law being kind of one of the forms that Judaism had taken over time, but perhaps no longer being relevant or binding or valid. Anyway, in 1837, Auerbach publishes this novel Spinoza, and we know, from letters that he had sent to his cousin Jakob Auerbach. We have these letters were published in the late 19th century. We know that Auerbach really experienced a very intense feeling of kinship with Spinoza, and that's also something that I was really interested in. In my book, is the extent of identification that many, Jewish intellectuals would come to feel with Spinoza. So I'm not saying that, Auerbach is absolutely the first to experience this. Around the same time, you also have Heinrich Heine, who is writing about Spinoza, who also felt an intense kinship with Spinoza in the 18th century. This figure, who was also kind of like the black sheep of the Berlin Haskalah, Solomon Maimon, seems to, for a time, to have experienced this feeling of identification with Spinoza. But Auerbach is really a kind of a crucial figure in not only experiencing this, but first, trying to write a kind of a whole historical novel about Spinoza that focused on kind of reimagining his early years up until really his excommunication. In other words, a period that had been treated relatively briefly in the early biographies of Spinoza from the 17th century, Auerbach enlarges considerably and really kind of seems to kind of imagine Spinoza's break with Sephardic Amsterdam as this kind of crucial revolutionary rupture, right? This beginning of something new, of a new type of, cosmopolitan identity, of a new type of Jewish identity. And so, that chapter on Auerbach, I actually kind of in many ways began some of my research with Auerbach because I see him as being such a crucial figure in the story that I tell. I actually entitled that particular chapter "The First Modern Jew" because I really see that image as emanating from Auerbach's novel. And Auerbach would later go on to translate all of Spinoza's work, at least Spinoza's work that was extant at the time, into German. And he did this only a few years later, even before he got around to writing these Dorfgeschichten, before he became this major European writer. I would say one thing that was really interesting about Auerbach, and this distinguishes him from, say someone like Heine, with whom he was really, they had a kind of enmity between them. But Auerbach, became, essentially we would call him almost today like a kind of secular Jew, or a liberal Jew. But, he became fairly, estranged from any kind of Jewish religious practice. But he never converted. He refused to convert to Christianity. It's really, I think, for him primarily, a kind of an issue of honor and a sense of this is where I come from. This is part of what's made me who I am. But, you know, he became, in some ways, Auerbach himself became something of a kind of culture hero for 19th century German Jews, precisely because he was such a well-known author who had developed an international reputation, but had nevertheless refused to convert. You know, he had remained a Jew.
To continue this line of thought, can you expand a little bit on what you mean by the quote-unquote image of Spinoza? Throughout the book, we see that Spinoza was seen at once as a threat, while he was also seen as a hero. What do you think contributes to this mutability?
I think there are kind of like two questions there. So, you know, in terms of the image of Spinoza, you know, I think maybe perhaps, you know, another way of saying is that I was interested primarily in kind of perceptions of Spinoza. And that might include everything from his biographical image to ideas associated with him. But in other words, this wasn't going to be a kind of reception history of the theological political treatise. This was going to be, as you said in your opening remarks, in some ways I was interested in kind of Spinoza as a kind of cultural figure in the modern Jewish pantheon of heroes. And essentially, I mean, you know, one of the titles that I flirted with before settling on the first modern Jew was the title From Heretic to Hero. Or, you know, the heretic as hero, because what I was really interested in was kind of tracing this process of rehabilitation, even if it remained controversial, even if there remained kind of detractors, many detractors, those who kind of wouldn't go along with it. But, you know, I think that what you have by the 19th century, the mid-19th century, late 19th century, certainly by the early 20th century, you know, is this sense of, you know, you have those who view Spinoza as truly a hero, you know, often kind of Jewish intellectuals who had experienced their own kind of rupture with you know, traditional Jewish life with the Jewish community, some of whom had even experienced some type of version of excommunication, but who had become alienated, who had become estranged, and who kind of traced a kind of spiritual paternity back to Spinoza. So you have kind of, you know, that group on the one hand, those who kind of really view Spinoza as a hero of kind of modern Jewish identity. You have those, and I don't really spend as much time focusing on this group in this particular book, largely because in many ways I was more interested in the process of rehabilitation. But you have those who continue to view Spinoza as a great villain, as somebody who had truly kind of perverted what Judaism was all about. Somebody like the 19th century Italian rabbi, contributor to Haskalah literature, Samuel David Luzzatto, sometimes known as Shadal, or the 20th century German Jewish neo-Kantian philosopher Hermann Cohen, who viewed Spinoza, you know, they didn't see him as kind of part of this you know, lineage of prophets and rebels, you know, but as, you know, kind of part of a different genealogy, right? I mean, as part of a genealogy of apostates, right? Even though Spinoza hadn't formally converted, they essentially viewed him as having defected. They saw him as having kind of defected to the other side and become a great kind of accuser of Judaism because of some of the quite harsh things that he has to say about Judaism in the theological political treatise. So you have those on the other hand, and then I would say you have this kind of middle ground of people who, you know, they feel on the one hand that, you know, they regret the excommunication. They see Spinoza as a kind of certainly this amazing philosopher who came out of Judaism, who had this, you know, kind of sterling character, even while they kind of are made uncomfortable by aspects of his philosophy, and in particular by his critique of Judaism in the theological political treatise. So you have this whole middle ground of people who want, on the one hand, to kind of bring Spinoza back into the fold, and yet don't want to kind of you know, lionize him to the degree that, you know, the camp that I mentioned earlier, those who see Spinoza as, you know, simply a hero, wanted to do.
Your next chapter studies the Eastern European Haskalah, or Jewish Enlightenment. What do you see as the role of Spinoza here, and does it relate to his reception in the European Enlightenment in general?
What's interesting about the, you know, the Jewish Enlightenment is that, you know, when we think about the Enlightenment, we tend to think about a movement in Europe that was, you know, primarily centered in the second half of the 17th century, and particular in the 18th century, right? And by the late 18th century, in terms of just, you know, kind of periodization, this is where we have this kind of transition from the Enlightenment to Romanticism. What's interesting about the Jewish Enlightenment, or the Haskalah, is that it does begin in the 18th century, but it really experiences its high point in East Central Europe, in Austrian Galicia, in the Tsarist Empire, in the middle decades of the 19th century, to the point that, you know, there was even a book that was written a few years ago by a scholar named Olga Lidbach, where she essentially argued that the Haskalah should be interpreted as the kind of romantic movement in Judaism. So I'm not, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. But I, you know, I think that, you know, there were, you know, some differences in terms of how Spinoza, you know, was received in the kind of 18th century Enlightenment, as opposed to how he is received in the 19th century Haskalah. I think that, you know, Spinoza in the 19th century Haskalah, and I was looking, you know, primarily a lot of Haskalah literature, you know, was written in Hebrew. And so I was looking, you know, at kind of Spinoza, you know, in kind of 19th century Hebrew, and in particular in the work of this Galician maskil named Solomon or Shlomo Rubin, who was the first to translate the Ethics into Hebrew, a work that was complete in 1885, but already 30 years before that, he publishes a work that's supposed to be kind of like the beginning of this translation, which is called, you know, in Hebrew, Mora Nevuchim Hechadash, or essentially like the new guide to the perplexed. In other words, Spinoza is kind of like the new Maimonides, Spinoza as a replacement for Maimonides. And what I see in this work, what I see in a lot of the work of these maskilim who are receiving Spinoza enthusiastically, is this fundamental tension between, on the one hand, seeing Spinoza as a kind of figure of rupture, as a kind of a break with the past, as something fundamentally new. And this, you know, kind of does dovetail with what, you know, scholars like Jonathan Israel, for example, have argued about the role of Spinoza in the kind of radical Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th century, right? This figure who, as opposed to trying to represent some type of conciliation between religion and reason, is arguing for kind of a revolutionary break with tradition. So you have that element, but you also have this element, this effort to kind of anchor Spinoza kind of within a kind of secret history of Judaism, you know, to try to kind of excavate Jewish sources for Spinoza's thought. Everything from stray rabbinic phrases to passages from the Zohar. In other words, there's an attempt to see Spinoza as kind of a fully Jewish figure, even in his heresy. Right. In other words, that his heresy, you know, is kind of part of this almost like counter history that runs through Jewish history. So, you know, that's an element that you don't really see, you know, in, you know, the kind of 17th, 18th century European Enlightenment, but is a major part of Spinoza's reception in the 19th century Haskalah, or the 19th century Jewish Enlightenment.
Your second to last site of reception is Jerusalem. In the first half of the 20th century, as Jews sought to understand Jewish nationalism and secularism, and sort of the legacy of the quote-unquote Jewish question. So what was Zionism's relationship to Spinoza?
you know, Zionism had a, you know, a kind of a I would say a kind of an interesting relationship to Spinoza. I would say it was certainly not a uniform relationship to Spinoza, but there was a, you know, there was definitely an openness to Spinoza, which, you know, on the surface at least would seem to be somewhat surprising, right? I mean, if we think about Spinoza as somebody who is, you know, this kind of prototype of the individual breaking from the community, you know, kind of leaving, you know, the Zionist historian Yitzhak or Fritz Baer called him, you know, the first Jew to kind of leave Judaism, you know, without kind of undergoing a religious conversion, right? So if you see him as a defector, as you see in that way, you would think, well, how does he, you know, kind of fit into a movement, you know, that like all kind of nationalist movements, is emphasizing in some ways the primacy of the collective, right? The primacy of these kind of communal, the, you know, ties, this sense of national solidarity, you know, over the individual. And yet there is this whole Zionist rehabilitation of Spinoza. So I kind of looked at two elements of this. And again, this is primarily focused on secular Zionism. Although there is even some, I didn't really write about this so much in the book, but there is something of reception of Spinoza among religious Zionists as well, which tends to be negative or at least critical, but not, you know, sometimes completely so. In other words, some of the religious Zionists, figures like Ruff Cook, for example, you know, saw in the same way that Mendelssohn saw, you know, elements of Spinozism that could be refined. You know, Cook saw Spinoza's pantheism in some ways in a similar way. But in the chapter that I deal with, I'm interested primarily in two, you know, ways in which Zionists kind of related to Spinoza. One was by seeing him as a forerunner of Zionism. And this has to do with this passage toward the very end of chapter 3 of the Theological Political Treatise, where Spinoza seems to hold out the possibility that the Jews, if they can overcome the kind of emasculating effects of their own religion, which, you know, seems to kind of refer to this kind of like passive messianism, this kind of waiting for the Messiah to happen, to come, I'm sorry, you know, through some type of miraculous means, that, you know, if they're able to overcome this, that they might someday restore, they might reclaim, you know, sovereignty, they might reestablish a Jewish state. And so this is a passage that doesn't really seem to have garnered much attention until you have the emergence of a Jewish national movement. But once you did, and people began kind of trying to kind of ransack the past for figures who might be considered precursors, people discovered this passage by Spinoza and said, oh, you know, here we have somebody who can be seen as something of a forerunner of Zionism. And so, you know, a major figure here was a Jewish historian named Ben-Zion Dinaburg, or as he later, you know, Hebraized his name, Ben-Zion Dinur, who was a Jewish historian, actually became the minister of education in Israel in the 1950s. But another crucial figure in this vein was David Ben-Gurion himself, who was also an extremely a great Spinoza enthusiast, and somebody who even, you know, pushed for the translation of all of Spinoza's works into Hebrew in the 1950s while he was, you know, prime minister, and published a very controversial article in the 1950s that was at least understood as calling for a rescinding of the cherem, or of the excommunication, the ban on Spinoza. So kind of one approach that Zionists who were drawn to Spinoza took to him was to see him as this, if not founder of Zionism, at least as a kind of a forerunner, at least as a precursor, what would be called in Hebrew, one of the mivasrei hatzionut, one of the precursors, the forerunners of Zionism. But I also looked at the impact that a kind of secularization of Jewish of Judaism in general, right? This whole idea in cultural Zionism of, you know, the primacy of culture, right? Of basically trying to kind of transform a religion into a culture that, you know, well, it was debated what exactly the relationship should be between this culture and traditional, you know, religious texts and sources. But once you have this kind of secularization of Judaism, you kind of expand the purview of perhaps, you know, who can be included within the fold. And so that was kind of like another you know, way in which some Zionists, those who didn't necessarily even go for this whole idea of Spinoza as a forerunner of Zionism, but nevertheless wanted to see him as part, you know, of, you know, the Jewish cultural tradition, part of Jewish heritage, as a Jewish philosopher. And, you know, through this, you know, kind of cultural redefinition of Judaism, that was their way of kind of spiriting him back, you know, through, you know, the door. And so in that chapter, you know, I focus in particular, in each chapter, I tend to focus on one, you know, figure in particular, but to try to kind of situate them in as broad a discourse as possible. So the figure that I focused on in that particular chapter was an important East European turned Palestinian Hebrew intellectual from the, you know, the Russian Empire, named Yosef Klausner, who became a professor at the Hebrew University when it was first established in 1925. And in 1927, when they were commemorating around the globe the 250th anniversary of Spinoza's death, there was actually a, you know, there was a ceremony held at Hebrew University. And he gave a speech that was, you know, titled, you know, to translate into English, like the Jewish character of Spinoza's philosophy. And what's interesting is that he, you know, he takes a somewhat kind of ambivalent approach to Spinoza's Jewishness throughout the essay, but he closes it by reciting the traditional formula that was used to kind of lift the cherem on an individual. He says basically in Hebrew, "Achinu ata, achinu ata, achinu ata," or you are our brother, you are our brother, you are our brother. So there was this way in which, you know, this kind of secular Zionist, Yosef Klausner, was resorting to this traditional religious formula in order to kind of imply that Spinoza, you know, was once again back within the fold, and to almost kind of give this, you know, that kind of the, at least the impression of some type of religious imprimatur.
I think one of the exciting things about your book is not only the character of the local points of reception that you investigate, but I think as becomes evident from much of our discussion is the continuities you're able to find, the struggle with Spinoza, this adoption of Spinoza across different periods and different spaces. The final sort of point that you deal with is Spinoza's reception in the fictional works of Nobel Prize laureate Yitzhak Pashevis Singer. So can you reflect a little bit about the role he plays? It's an interesting one, and I think a little bit of a unique case study in the work of Singer.
Yeah, this was like one of the later chapters that I added as the kind of manuscript took shape. But, you know, what struck me about Singer's writing was that there really isn't anything about Spinoza per se. You know, in other words, in all the other chapters I had looked at, authors, philosophers, politicians who were engaging with, you know, the life of Spinoza in some fashion. And actually, Singer doesn't do this. I mean, apparently there is some work in his archives in Texas, you know, where he took a stab at it, but he never published anything on it. But what's interesting is that in many of Singer's writings, and two in particular, a work that was translated, a story that was translated as the Spinoza of Market Street, and also this, you know, kind of massive novel called The Family Muscat, what you have is a figure who is, of a character who is basically a Spinozist, a character who is basically enthralled with Spinoza. In the Family Muscat, the introduction to this figure, Asa Heschel, when you first meet him in chapter two, he kind of arrives in Warsaw and basically almost has nothing to his name except the copy of Spinoza's Ethics. Right. So what was interesting to me was that already when you come to Singer, it's almost as if this kind of reception, this rehabilitation of Spinoza has become a theme in its own right. It's become part of the culture to the point that it can be kind of ironized, that it can be criticized. And I really see Singer as kind of approaching Spinoza in a more critical vein than, some of the figures that I, had studied to that point in the book.
The points of reception you discuss in the book cover both works of fiction and of nonfiction. And I wanted to ask you what the difference between the two types of works are with regards to reception history. If Spinoza's image was indeed so flexible, is that not in a sense a fiction?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think, and that's a good question about reception history in general. And I would say that very often these images of Spinoza that were being produced, I think, were somewhat fictitious. In other words, the individuals who I was studying, they were kind of creating a Spinoza who felt somewhat kind of closer to them, right? Who could be a kind of spiritual, father figure, a figure that they would feel a special kinship with, or who could be seen as kind of inaugurating the very kind of Jewish identity that they themselves were, kind of constructing. So I do see there as being something fictitious. But, early in the book, there was a quote by Moshe Idel, the great, scholar of the Kabbalah, that I remember kind of encountering when I was writing the book, and in particularly the introduction, that read something like, I'm paraphrasing here, but that like the history of misunderstandings is as important as the history of understandings. And that, it is true that, that there were distortions, to the historical Spinoza, to the Spinoza of history. In many ways, what I'm studying more in this book is, you could call it, as I call it, the Spinoza of memory. But that, that's part of understanding reception, right? Is very frequently ideas, they do get reinterpreted, they do get reworked, they do get repackaged, right? But if you want to understand the actual impact that they have, that's not to say it's not important to try to like set the record straight, to, that we still have works that are on Spinoza himself and that establish a clear divide between, again, the Spinoza of history and the Spinoza of memory. But we can't simply, in my opinion, kind of reject the reception, or at least those aspects of the reception that seem more kind of mythological, right? Simply because we're saying, well, that's just a fiction. That's not really who Spinoza was. Well, if we want to understand what Spinoza's impact was, what he came to mean as a cultural figure, then we have to explore these works. And those works might be works of fiction. They might be works of, kind of publicistic writing that was common in the 19th century Jewish Enlightenment. They might be newspaper articles. They might be journal articles. They might be anniversary tributes. They might be books. They might be all sorts of things. But I think, in terms of trying to understand Spinoza as symbol, Spinoza as a cultural figure, all of those are important.
To conclude our interview, I would like to ask you to reflect on the role of the image of Spinoza as it plays out today. Where does he feature, and do you think his image remains potent?
I think that's really, it's an interesting question. And, you know, I think I've been really struck, and partly one of the things that really did strike me when I was writing the book was the extent to which, you know, Spinoza was experiencing, it seemed, you know, in the kind of early, late 90s, you know, into the 21st century, something of a revival. And that's a revival in philosophical circles, but also, you know, this continued interest in Spinoza as a kind of cultural figure. I mean, just in Washington, D.C., where I live and teach, several years ago, there was a play written by a non-Jewish playwright named David Ives, but it was about the excommunication of Spinoza. There was a showing of this play, and it was wildly popular. They brought it back for another showing at this, you know, Theater J here in D.C. And then they held this whole event one day called was called the Spinozium, where they had not only experts in Spinoza or 17th century Amsterdam, you know, share of their expertise, but they actually had a kind of an argument by, you know, two well-known Jewish lawyers in town for and against Spinoza's excommunication. And apparently in Amsterdam, about, you know, maybe a little over 2 years ago, they even had an event, I think it was like in December 2015, where they revisited the Cheirem. So I think that, you know, there really is, you know, this, you know, continued interest in Spinoza. You know, again, I think there's always different elements to this. And, you know, one I haven't gotten as much into, in part because it's not as much the subject of my book, you know, why Spinoza continues to provoke so much debate in terms of his actual philosophy. And that has to do, I think, with a lot, you know, of the kind of ambiguities in his philosophy, ways in which, you know, different parts of his philosophy can be read differently, or the way in which just his philosophy stands almost in this kind of world of its own, where it, you know, it can't be reduced to either kind of an idealist or a materialist reading. It seems to be kind of both simultaneously. But there's also been this, you know, kind of perennial debate over Spinoza's Jewishness and what that Jewishness meant, if it meant anything at all, what it consisted of. And I think, you know, that, you know, that remains, you know, a debate that shows kind of no sign of abating. And partly, you know, what I suggest at the end of my book is, you know, it's partly what I'm tracing in the book is often, very often, Jewish intellectuals developed a connection to Spinoza as part of their experience of becoming estranged from tradition. So that, you know, reading Spinoza's Ethics in secret, or Spinoza's Ethics becoming a kind of surrogate Bible for them, right? It became almost a kind of surrogate religion, in the way that Jewish secularism for a time became something of a surrogate religion. And, you know, what I see often happening today, you know, is, you know, that often Jews who have very little connection to Judaism. And this is not something that is a kind of a process that they've undergone. It's almost a kind of, it's just part of their inheritance, right? They've grown up with very little Jewish content in their lives, and yet are often sometimes drawn to these outsider-like figures like Spinoza. And, you know, so what I speculate in the end, very end of my book, is that for some of these figures, perhaps Spinoza is not almost like the way out, you know, from Judaism, or at least from a kind of an orthodox or traditional type of Judaism, but is a way almost kind of like back toward. It's a way of kind of expressing a Jewish identity that has become much thinner.
I would like to end our interview today by thanking Professor Schwartz for joining us on the Jewish Studies channel of the New Books Network. We've been talking about his wonderful book, The First Modern Jew, Spinoza and the History of an Image, published in 2012 by Princeton University Press.